comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell and CFRC's Arts Coordinator Genevieve Hinch. Our top story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Era McCauley, covering the development of the Welcoming Agency's declaration by the Kingston Immigration Partnership.
Hello, I'm Era McCauley, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today on YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach out to our news team at news@cfrc.ca. Four Kingston newcomer serving organizations have come together to develop the Welcoming Agency's Declaration. Developed by the Kingston Immigration Partnership, the declaration represents a commitment between Kingston Community Health Centers, Keys Employment and Newcomer Services, ACFOME, and Kingston Literacy and Skills to reduce barriers for people with irregular immigration status. The declaration ensures access to support and services for individuals without fear of having their immigration status reported to the Canada Border Services Agency, CBSA, or police for the purposes of deportation or immigration detention. CFRC spoke with Yujir Ku, coordinator of Kingston Immigration Partnership, about the declaration.
So you have a pretty exciting initiative that has just been announced in the Welcoming Agency's Declaration. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, but perhaps start by letting listeners know, what is the Kingston Immigration Partnership?
Kingston Immigration Partnership was formed in 2009 by a collection of agencies that worked together
to make a more welcoming community, Kingston in particular, for newcomers to Canada. So this initiative in particular, we have four agencies in collaboration with Kingston Community Health Centers, Keys Employment and Newcomer Services, ACFOME, and Kingston Literacy and Skills.
What does this declaration aim to do here in Kingston?
There are some folks in our community who live with irregular immigration status. That might be a new term for a lot of folks, but sometimes you'll hear them referred to as undocumented or non-status. These are individuals who will experience significant barriers in accessing especially essential services. And that is what we have seen in the community. There are folks who are afraid to seek emergency healthcare services or seek protection as victims of violence. And we want them to know where they can safely access support without fear that their immigration status will be reported for the purposes of deportation or immigration detention to CBSA or the police.
Studies show that having a regular immigration status can lead individuals to delay seeking health care, support related to gender-based violence or human trafficking, labor protections, and other essential services, increasing the risk to their health and well-being.
Irregular immigration status can occur for a number of reasons. People might have preconceived notions about how someone ends up in this situation, but it can be more nuanced.
Yes, absolutely. A lot of the folks that we see with irregular immigration status might not know that they have irregular immigration status. Sometimes they might have accidentally let some documents expire or just lapse. I know I've left, let's say, my OHIP card expire before, but the consequences are unfortunately very real for a lot of individuals, where they might not have noticed the dates and it's expired. For some other individuals, we have been making some changes in Canada to some of our immigration policies and processes, so that it is more difficult for individuals to make a claim for refugee protection. For example, in 2023, our Safe Third Country Agreement with between Canada and the USA expanded so that it was more difficult for some individuals to make a refugee claim in Canada if they have previously been in the US. There is also the introduction of Bill C-12, where it required someone to make a refugee claim within the first year of arrival to Canada.
According to the Government of Canada, Bill C-12 introduced new eligibility requirements for asylum claims made on or after June 3, 2025 to, quote, reduce pressure on the asylum system, protect it against sudden increases in claims, close loopholes, and deter people from claiming asylum as a shortcut to regular immigration pathways. In addition to the one-year time limit, asylum claims from people who enter Canada between ports of entry along the Canada-US land border and who make a claim after 14 days will not be referred to the Immigration and Refugee Board of Canada. They note that guidance will be provided to officers to consider the individual circumstances of unaccompanied minors, given their lack of legal guardianship. Kingston Immigration Partnership argues that this new policy leaves some asylum seekers at risk.
For some individuals, this is not possible. For example, if you're part of the 2S LGBTQ community, or let's say you're a victim of intimate partner violence, you might not report it or feel safe to come out within your first year of arrival to Canada. But if your home country doesn't have any protections to keep you safe, you might want to continue seeking safety in Canada. But unfortunately, you will no longer be able to make a refugee claim, with some exceptions.
And this is an extension, as you've referenced, to a City of Kingston policy that came into effect in 2017, which affirmed that Kingston residents should have meaningful access to city services without fear and should not have their immigration status reported to the Canada Border Services Agency or police. What do you hope with this partnership? Because I imagine that you're hoping to expand it in future.
Yes, so City of Kingston has adopted the Access Without Fear policy in 2017, which is a sanctuary city-like policy. And as a result, which is really great, we would like to expand it to many more organizations within the community. So we welcome and encourage all community organizations that serve newcomers who want to make sure that their services are accessible and let people know that they are welcomed to reach out to us.
And for an individual who might be hearing this and might feel like this is an opportunity to seek out services but might not know where to start, what would your recommendation be?
So those four agencies that we talked about earlier, they have affirmed that they will not report your immigration status voluntarily to CBSA or police. So if you do want support or need support, I would recommend you booking an appointment with one of the four agencies.
How long has this been in the planning stages for, and what has it meant for you and for the other agencies to come together and be able to make this declaration?
This has been in the planning for, I want to say, months at this point. It is something we are very excited about because it really shows our organizational values. We want to make sure that our services are welcoming to more.
I would imagine this is a really welcome announcement for a lot of organizations and a lot of individuals.
Do you have any concerns over backlash? Have you had any response from the community so far to this announcement?
Well, we have actually not received any backlash. There has been a lot of support, a lot of organizations and people who have reached out to say that they're happy that we've enacted like something like this. I suppose in the future we might receive some. But know that we understand why we are actually doing this and the community that we serve.
So what are the next steps for you and for the other groups? Is just implementation, getting the word out, I imagine, as well?
Absolutely. So the next step would definitely be implementation. And there is also ongoing training for all of our staff and any agencies that join on to this declaration. But what we really want other folks to know about and other agencies to know about is why we have this declaration and some information sharing and education.
And if people want to learn more about it as an organization, do they get in touch with you or reach out to any of the different partners? Are there resources out there?
All the options are great. We also have a webpage, but if you're also curious to know more information, we recommend you reaching out to our email address at info@kchc.ca. We're just so excited to share with our community about how we're working together to make it more welcoming for more people.
All right. Well, congratulations on the declaration, and I look forward to seeing how it expands.
Thank you, Era. Now over to Dinah Jansen with a story by Michelle Dory Forrestel, LGI reporter for The Kingstonist, about the proposed timeline for the cleanup of a Bridge Street property in Napanee.
Thank you, Jesse. The town of Greater Napanee says it's continuing to work with social service agencies, police, and the owner of a Bridge Street property that was recently found by the court to be unfit and unsafe for human habitation. In a written response to the Kingstonist on Monday, June 1st, town communication staff confirmed that municipal officials have been holding regular meetings regarding 1388 Bridge Street following a court-ordered injunction requiring cleanup of the property. According to Kylie Huffman, communications coordinator for the town of Greater Napanee, those meetings have involved the town's chief administrative officer, fire chief, senior bylaw officer, and clerk, as well as Prince Edward Lennox and Addington Social Services, other social service agencies, and the Ontario Provincial Police. Huffman said the work the town has undertaken to this point has largely focused on steps for those living illegally at 1388 Bridge Street. The update comes after the Ontario Superior Court of Justice issued an injunction requiring action at the property, which the court found was unfit and unsafe for human habitation. The order requires the site to be cleaned up, but the town said it was working with partner agencies before proceeding with any enforcement that could affect people still living there. Huffman said the town has also been in regular contact with the property owner, who has indicated that cleanup efforts are underway. However, she said the town is not yet sure of the extent of that work. The town has previously indicated that if it is forced to take on the cleanup itself, the cost would be high. Huffman said that estimate has not changed. Huffman said the town will also need to inspect the property to assess its condition and will work with external agencies to ensure that the details laid out in the court order are adhered to and that community safety obligations are met. While the town does not expect to issue a public notice before any enforcement action, it does anticipate that there will be full reporting to council in open session about the steps that have been taken, are being taken, and will need to be taken, as well as any associated costs, Huffman wrote. The town also said CAO Matthew Grant is leading the municipality's efforts on the file. The response suggests the municipality is attempting to balance enforcement of the court order with the reality that people have been living at the property and may require support before the site can be cleared. While the injunction sets the legal framework for cleanup, the town's latest updates indicate that enforcement may, at least in the short term, depend on whether the property owner continues to make progress and whether social service agencies can help relocate any remaining occupants.
Thank you, Dinah, and thank you to Michelle Dory Forrestel of The Kingstonist for that story. Coming up, we have a story by Ted Evans, LJI reporter for CJAI Amherst Island Radio, with a fundraising update related to the W.J. Henderson Revitalization Project.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca.
Loyalist Township has announced they've passed 80% of their fundraising goal for the W.J. Henderson Revitalization Campaign. With construction underway, donations continue to bring them closer to their $2 million goal. Volunteer and donor to the campaign, Jennifer, speaks about why she got involved and notes how donations can be made.
I believe spaces like this foster a sense of community. Even though I've only been living in Loyalist for a few years, supporting this campaign felt like a meaningful way to help ensure that everyone in our community will have a bright, modern space to connect, stay active, and make memories. A gift of $1,000 will be permanently recognized on our donor wall, creating a lasting legacy for you or your family. You can also make your donation conveniently in installments with automatic payments at the interval of your choosing. That's how I contributed to the campaign.
The township is preparing to reopen the Bar Homes Aquatic Center later this summer. The Dig and Dirt Atrium is closed to the public until June 8th. During this time, library access remains available. Until then, access to the center is provided via the lower level entrance by the arena dressing rooms. As the campaign moves towards completion, the township is looking back on the past 50 years during which the building has served as a gathering place for the community. The township is inviting community members to share moments that have shaped the building's history. Photos, stories, and memories should be submitted by August 31st, 2026. All submissions will be entered into a free draw to win one free hour of ice time. Selected submissions may be featured on digital displays inside the center. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Coming up, we have Genevieve Hinch reading a story by Keith Dempsey, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, about local reactions to the possibility of a four-day work week.
Thank you, Dinah. A new staff report headed to Gananoque Council suggests that municipal employees are generally supportive of flexible scheduling options, but indicates a town-wide four-day work week would present operational challenges in several departments. The report was prepared in response to a directive issued by Mayor John Beddoes in April, which directed senior staff to examine the potential advantages and disadvantages of flexible hours, compressed work schedules, and a possible four-day work week for municipal employees. The report found that many departments already use some form of flexible scheduling, particularly to accommodate evening meetings, emergency response requirements, and after-hour work. Several departments, including corporate services, finance, planning, public works, and utilities, reported that flex hours have proven beneficial for employees' work-life balance and can help staffers attend appointments or family commitments without using vacation time. Staff also identified potential benefits to compressed work schedules. Corporate services noted that extended daily hours could allow Town Hall to remain open later into the evening, while giving employees an additional day off. One option discussed would see Town Hall operate from 8:30 a.m. to 6 p.m., Monday through Thursday, potentially improving access for residents who work traditional weekday hours. The report also suggests modest operational savings could result from three-day Town Hall closure each week through reduced utility consumption, cleaning costs, and maintenance requirements. However, staff cautioned that a four-day work week would not be practical across all municipal operations. Public Works staff noted any permanent change would require amendments to the town's collective agreement and could create challenges during the winter maintenance season. Utility staff highlighted legislated seven-day operational requirements for water and waterway facilities, while Parks and Recreation Management warned reduced weekday staffing could affect service delivery and maintenance activities during the busy summer season. Gananoque Fire Service staff expressed support for continued flexibility, noting firefighters frequently work outside normal business hours for emergency calls, training, and community response activities. The department said flexible scheduling helps maintain employee morale and supports work-life balance. Economic development, tourism, and communication staffers also reported that their schedules already require considerable flexibility due to festivals, events, and tourism-related responsibilities, making a traditional four-day model less impactful than in other departments. The report does not recommend a specific course of action. Instead, it provides council with an overview of how each department could be affected by scheduling changes and identifies areas where further discussion may be warranted.
And thank you to Genevieve Hinch and Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with the Kingston Sports Report, brought to you by CFRC Power Plays.
It was an eventful weekend football-wise here in the city of Kingston, as the Kingston Grenadiers had three home games on Saturday at Richardson Memorial Stadium. In the first of three games, the U16 AAA squad defeated Huronia by a score of 16-14 on a last-minute field goal. A clutch kick made by a high school age kid certainly will get the scouts taking notice. In the second game, the AAA U18 Grenadiers had a much easier time with their opponents, winning handedly 48-10 over Sault Ste. Marie, locking up first place in the Eastern Division for the Kingston Grenadiers U18 squad. And then in the closer, the U14 Grenadiers had a hard-fought defensive stalemate of a 12-6 victory over the Durham Dolphins. A huge victory for the U14 squad as they look to fight for playoff positioning in the Ontario Summer Football League. Continuing on the trend of local football news, former Queens Gales linebacker Justin Pace has successfully made the Edmonton Elks regular season roster, signing his first professional contract late last week. While Pace will no longer be eligible for U-Sports play, he is looking forward to a long and productive career at the professional level. We here at CFRC congratulate Justin Pace on his accomplishments, both in university and now in the realms of professional football. That's a wrap for your sports report brought to you by CFRC Power Plays. Over now to Genevieve Hinch with the community concert and events calendar.
And thank you, Jesse, for that update. And also thank you to our sponsor. Today's edition of The Corridor is brought to you by Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Learn more about Kim and local listings for your new home via kimpurcell.ca. Coming up, Jesse Bell is bringing you the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Tuesday, June 9th, the warmest day of the year so far here in the Limestone City. Sunny conditions, daytime high of 30 degrees, but it is going to cool off a little bit overnight as we have a 60% chance of precipitation in the forecast. Wednesday, June 10th, 27 is your high with a 40% chance of rain, dropping down to a 30% chance of precipitation overnight and a low of 17. Thursday, June 11th, another hot day, the start of a run of warm weather. 29 is your high with a 30% chance of rain, only going down to 22 overnight, so it's going to be quite warm even overnight here in the city of Kingston. Friday, June 12th, 29 degrees is your high with a 30% chance of rain, dropping down to 16 degrees and cloudy overnight. Saturday, June 13th, just in time for Pride here in the city of Kingston, we have got a beautiful 27 degree day with a mix of sun and cloud. Sunday, June 14th, there is a 40% chance of rain in the forecast with a high of 26. And then kicking off next week, Monday, June 15th, 27 is your high with a 45% chance of rain. Coming up next, we go back to Genevieve Hinch with CFRC's concert and events calendar.
Hello, Kingston, and welcome back to CFRC 101.9 FM. Broadcasting from Kingston, Ontario, I'm CFRC's Community News and Arts Coordinator, Jenny. And this is your weekly events and concerts calendar brought to you by Flying V Productions. Whether you're looking for live music, pride celebrations, community festivals, workshop theaters, or just something fun to do around the city, there's plenty happening this week, so let's get into it. On Wednesday, community events take center stage. Teens can head to Rideau Heights Branch for games and grub in the afternoon, while Kingston Nexus hosts a board game night beginning at 6 p.m. The Ground Up Dance Festival arrives at the Theatre La Sesame at 7 p.m. and showcasing contemporary dance and performances from across the region. Live music highlights include Glenn Jones, Liam Grant, and Jack Pine performing at Something Else Records, while Dan Byrne and Orit Shimoni take the stage at the Broom Factory later that evening. Thursday definitely keeps things busy with the Kingston Public Market running all day in Springer Market Square. The Central Branch Library hosts a Get Ready for Pride workshop, while Calvin Park Branch presents Roots and Remedies, exploring Indigenous teachings and traditions. In the evening, Drag Bingo returns to Daff Brewing from 7 to 11 p.m. Live music includes Mallory Chipman at the Cove Inn, Ted Lalonde at Time Out Bar, and KBS Monthly Jam at the RCHA Club. Friday is packed with entertainment across the city. Musiki Cafe hosts its live drag and burlesque from 5 to 7 p.m., while The Spire welcomes Canadian comedy and musical favorites The Arrogant Worms for a concert and music talk beginning at 7. Live music includes Orkstar Criminal at Hotel Wolf Island, Morgan Davis at the RCHA Club, and local favorite Squid Pistol performing at the Merchant Tap House later that night. Saturday is heading into Pride Weekend in Kingston. The community fair runs at Confederation Park from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., while Kingston Pride Parade begins at noon at the Memorial Center. Other highlights include YGK Beer Fest at Fort Henry, the Ukraine Folklore Festival at Regie, and an Ontario Serendipity Tour documentary screening at the Tet Center. In the evening, visitors can hop aboard the Out on the Queen Pride boat cruise. Catch comedian Jeff McHenry and at Daft Brewing, or dance the night away at Glow After Dark at La Vida Bistro and the Gay Pride Dance Party at Bottoms Up. Wrapping things up on Sunday, the Memorial Center Farmers Market runs from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. The Kingston Pride Recovery Brunch takes place at Wharf and Feather beginning at noon, and nature lovers can join a guided walk with KNCLN starting at 10:30 a.m. Live music includes Hawksley Workman and the Wolves at Signal Brewery, followed by Head Over Heels performing at the Cove Inn's waterside patio. This has been your weekly events and concerts calendar for June 8th through the 14th. And for more information on any of these events, visit the CFRC website and keep it locked right here on CFRC 101.9 FM. This events calendar is brought to you by Flying V Productions, bringing live theater, comedy, and unforgettable entertainment to audiences across Kingston. Be sure to check out their upcoming shows and events throughout the season. I'm Jenny, and thanks so much for listening. And have a great week, Kingston.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present Combinations, a fully self-produced one-man band release from Plune. Written, performed, and produced entirely by the artist, the track blends the experimental spirit of Beck with a raw, stripped-down folk rock edge reminiscent of Neil Young. Learn more about the artist and keep up with the latest by following them at Plune Music on Instagram. And if you're a local musician who would like airplay and social media coverage on our channels, complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit Kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Combinations by Plune on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
This is a rebroadcast. Please disregard any reference to dates or times. Welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I am your host of this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show anytime, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It's a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. And today, I'd like to introduce you to Abigail Bergeron, who is doing her PhD in philosophy under the supervision of Dr. Paul Fairfield. Welcome to Grad Chat, Abigail.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And before we dive into your research, I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about your academic journey up until this point. So where have you been and what brings you to Queen's?
Yeah, for sure. I came to Queen's a few years ago now to do my master's in philosophy. Before that, I went to Swansea University in the UK for law school. And then before that, I was at Trent University for philosophy. So I decided to come to Queen's because I've heard great things about Kingston. It's a beautiful city. And then I decided to stay here, and I ended up doing my second master's in law here at Queen's under Dr. Jacob Weinrib. And then now I'm in my third year of my PhD here with Dr. Fairfield.
Oh, very nice. So you've been to many places.
Yes.
And studied, it sounds like, a variety of topics, which I'm sure sounds like they're converging in your PhD. So hopefully we can chat about that a little bit more. So your current dissertation research focuses on the American philosopher Albert Borgman. Can you tell us a little bit about what your project entails?
Yeah. So Albert Borgman was an American philosopher who was born in 1937 and actually passed away relatively recently in 2023. He wrote several books on the philosophy, namely of technology, is what he's known for. But he also wrote about ethics, about ontology, philosophy of reality, philosophy of science, and a theory of history. So there's a lot more to Borgman than maybe is commonly known in the philosophical circles. And in terms of his specialty and what I'm working on, I'm actually trying to map, you know, his entire life and work and his legacy ultimately in like a master project. So up until now, you know, there's been a little bit of discussion about Borgman. Most of it is on his technology stuff, like I said, and a lot of it was happening in like the 90s when all this was, you know, getting popular. So a lot less so today. He's not a big name by any means in philosophy, but I'm hoping to kind of change that and introduce him back to a new generation of scholars. I think there's been a big dearth in terms of, you know, the philosophy of technology research generally, but then also having a more holistic picture of, you know, technology and what the good life means and what community means. And Borgman really sought to have a comprehensive project that answered all those questions. So my doctoral research is focused on then mainly three things, the first of which is, yes, to make the first long-form book kind of treatment of Borgman's life and work, instead of just, you know, there's a lot of essays and stuff, you know, applied work that I'm kind of looking at the big picture. And then secondly, to extend and defend a lot of the criticisms that kind of got unresolved in the literature back in the 80s and 90s. Borgman never directly resolved a lot of the problems that other people brought up with regards to some of his ideas and theories. And I feel like I might be able to kind of satisfy some of those questions. And of course, now that he's gone, he can't do it anymore. So I really want to answer those kind of lingering questions and criticisms. And then the third instance, I want to demonstrate Borgman's like continuing relevancy for today, both for, you know, the philosophy of technology, narrowly speaking, but also for, you know, a wider audience. Because towards Borgman's later years, he really sought to write for a more general audience as well. He felt like that was the proper place for philosophy, is not always just a technical kind of puzzle or discussion among experts, but, you know, a wider drawing in of people. So that'd be my main three aspects of my project.
Oh, very interesting. Well, that sounds like a massive undertaking. It sounds like a lot of work to be done and that you're doing currently, but it sounds exciting. And how did you first become interested in Borgman, and why did you choose him in particular to focus your doctoral dissertation work on?
I began looking and reading at Borgman a long time ago, actually, during my undergrad for an essay I was writing. And I came across him by accident. I was reading a book that kind of talked about, in a general way, the history of philosophy of technology. But he really kind of stuck out to me. And I read his main book on technology, and I really liked that book. But I felt like there was a lot of questions that I found really interesting and that, you know, he didn't really answer. So I felt like there was a lot to discuss there. And actually, at first, when I read Borgman, I was quite critical of him. I felt like his theory was too optimistic and didn't... And yeah, had too many questions, too many holes in it. But then the more that I've gone back and kind of read him for other assignments and other essays for different courses, I found, you know, how applicable he kind of is to everything. And I always knew that I wanted to do my dissertation on probably one philosopher versus a problem, because in philosophy, generally, you have a thesis or a dissertation that usually focuses on either like a problem, so like, you know, the question of truth or, you know, what is beauty, that kind of thing, or on a person. So, you know, there's a lot of people doing work on like Rawls or Heidegger or Nietzsche, you know, on the big names. So I wanted to do a person, but I didn't want to do a big name, so to speak. I was looking forward to kind of carving out my own kind of corner to work on someone who is less known and maybe try to popularize his work and his ideas and kind of bring them forward. So Borgman really fit that because not only, you know, he's not a big name, and I do feel like he's been neglected. And, you know, the more I kind of thought about it, the more I realized he was right about like so many things. And the more I started to like reflect on his work and how it relates to my own life, you know, the more I started to feel like my own life became like better in some ways because of what he was saying and the influence he had, especially his work in ethics. And, you know, kind of the virtues for daily life today, living in a technological society. And I really enjoyed his writing style, and I enjoyed his criticisms of philosophy in general. He was very critical of the profession towards the end of his career. So he said a lot of things that I can certainly relate to as a graduate student in the profession. And I found like he was a really just inspirational person the more I dug into his life and his work. So I really enjoyed kind of following his trail. I actually recently went to the University of Montana to do archival research there on his work. They hold an archive because he worked at the University of Montana for the last 50 years, actually.
Wow.
So he was there for 50 years, yes. And he had this house up in the mountain overlooking Rattlesnake Park, which is a wilderness conservation area. And it is just breathtaking. And going to Montana and like kind of seeing where he lived and where he worked and where he spent his time, like it you can see how much it informs his writing. And it definitely is a way of life that speaks to me as well. He was a big outdoorsman, hiker, a naturalist kind of person. So all of that really, really brought me into studying Borgman.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. And also that you were able to visit the site recently, right?
Yeah.
And that are all his personal papers there?
Yes.
Amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
What a collection of 50 years of work and all of the ephemera that have come with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very interesting. The unfortunate part was that a lot of his work is very handwritten, and like he used to write in pencil, like very, very tiny little cursive writing. So actually going through it is less fun, I will say. I do wish that more of it was typed, but he didn't, you know, he only typed usually the last draft. So it was just drafts and drafts of this handwritten, very faint writing. So, but yeah, it was very cool to look at the archive and even get to meet some people, some of the other professors and the faculty who knew him, obviously. So I got to meet a few of those people and hear about kind of Borgman and his stories and, you know, what he was like as a philosopher kind of thing. So I'm hoping to go back to the University of Montana in the next few years and do more research and talk to more people about Borgman's life and legacy.
Oh, that is such a nice aspect of your project that maybe other folks who study philosophers from a more distant past don't have the ability to do. So it's so nice that you have both his words, his thoughts, but also this community with which to discuss his work and his life. So that is very exciting. And you mentioned in kind of your summary of your work that Borgman is really focused, or I guess his most known work is for his work on technology. And in our contemporary moment, technology, especially different types of, you know, generative artificial intelligence, that seems to be kind of everywhere, kind of inescapable and kind of very front of mind for many people. So does Borgman offer anything that's really unique or illuminating on the current moment we find ourselves in? And can he offer things to both philosophers and non-philosophers that we should be considering?
Yeah. In terms of Borgman's philosophy of technology, I would say the first thing is that it was very prescient in terms of he wrote his main book in 1984. And a lot of the things he talks about in that book, you know, have only come more true as time goes on. And I really do like that in a philosopher, when philosophers kind of have this ability to kind of like look to the future and make, you know, these kind of long-term predictions, and then they turn out right. I think that's a real success for philosophers. I think in some sense that is very impressive. So in terms of his philosophy of technology today, I would say that it certainly has a lot to offer the general discussion on technology. Mm. A lot of the philosophy of technology today coming out of, you know, academic philosophy deals with specific, you know, technologies, mainly the idea that, you know, we need to examine the benefits and, you know, issues with this one type of technology. You know, for example, we see a lot of the discussion on social media. You know, how does social media, like, harm people? What are the harms? Or, you know, what does free speech mean on social media? You know, these kinds of very specific questions that are very important to policy. They're very important to research and development of these technologies. But there is, I think, missing a big picture kind of look at technology as a whole that we kind of saw back in the 50s and 60s with thinkers like Heidegger, who wrote about the question concerning technology as this kind of big way of being in the world today. And Borgman really followed Heidegger in a lot of that in terms of interpreting technology as the way we are in the world to some extent. And Borgman made it more specific, though, to, you know, our specific relationships. So his central philosophy of technology that he elucidates in his first book is that technology disrupts our relationships with, obviously, each other. Mm. You know, there's a lot of discussion about that, but also with our material world, our environments, and the things itself, right? Mm. So his whole theory he called back then was called the device paradigm. And he argued that devices were things that delivered us a product without any kind of skill or engagement with, you know, the world or with the device itself, right? And his example is a thermostat. You know, you go over and you click the button and now your house is getting warm. Mm. So with very little effort and no skill, no attention, no engagement needed, you know, you've now made your house warm. Mm-hmm. Versus before, you know, modern technology, before the, you know, the invention of central heating, you know, making your house warm would require, you know, effort, hours of effort of, you know, collecting the wood and building the fire, the knowledge and skill on how to start a fire, how to keep the fire going. You know, there's usually some kind of social, you know, grouping that kind of made the decisions on who keeps a fire going. So in a small family, it might be younger children who are in charge of that. In a, you know, big castle, it might be some of the servants. So there was this whole, like, wider context that wasn't just about making your house warm. It fed into this kind of reality that brought things together, right? Mm-hmm. There was a kind of engagement there. So his argument is that technological devices, he called them, interrupt or disrupt that kind of engagement with our bodily world. And, you know, there obviously is great, you know, devices that have brought us a lot of benefits. He talks about, for example, the invention of vaccines obviously prevented, you know, horrible childhood illnesses that, you know, unfortunately killed so many children back then. But at the same time, you know, he does note that kind of experience of going through a life-threatening childhood illness as a child. And he talks about his experience as a kid growing up in, you know, the 40s and you know, suffering from, I forget which disease he's talking about. But, you know, he remembers how, you know, vivid the fever dreams were. And for him, that was a formative experience, but it's definitely experience we can move beyond now, right? Mm-hmm. So he definitely does distinguish between, you know, the benefits of technology and, you know, the drawbacks. But he thinks that, you know, there's been a little bit too, we're going too far in the one direction towards more and more easy availability of things, right? Mm. Fast food's another great example. Like, you literally just go and you order it, well, you order it on the window or on the app, and then it just, you know, appears and you get this meal and you don't really have any of idea where the food came from. Like, you know, you don't know the cow the beef came from. You don't know the people who even made it. It's made in a very uniform way, you know. So that's another example of kind of, he calls it commodity. So what a device is for is a commodity. So a burger from McDonald's would be a commodity. The heat that you get from your thermostat is a commodity. And he means that in not the sense of, we might think of a commodity, but a commodity for him is just the way that something has been severed from its context. So when you know, take a burger and you mass produce it in a factory and then produce it at McDonald's or whatever, it's been taken from its context, right? Compared with, you know, actually you raising the cattle and slaughtering it and going through that whole process, that's something in its context. So anyway, his theory of technology then is really, I think, accurate in a lot of ways. And I think it's, even though he's writing this in the 80s, I think we can only see today how our lives have become more deviceness. And, you know, and literally in the sense of, we have, you know, iPads and smartwatches and stuff that literally give us anything we want at the push of a button. You know, Gen AI, ChatGPT, like, is kind of the ultimate device. It will tell you anything you want at the push of a button. And then you have to ask, like, you know, is that good for us? Is that good for our relationship with the wider world? You know, is it, you know, is there something missing when, instead of, you know, going out in the world and meeting people, you know, you're just sitting on your iPad and texting, you know, is there some kind of engagement loss there? You know, and I think part of that is trying to steer us away from the feeling that we need things easier and easier and faster and better, or else we're going to be unsatisfied. It's kind of, you know, like the hedonic treadmill, right? We're just kind of, we need more and more and more. And Borgman really has a clear line that, you know, we don't, and there's, you know, there's something good to be found in effort and engagement with the world, and we need to kind of have a mature relationship with technology, he argues, insofar as we need to limit devices and our use to them to, you know, what is strictly necessary, like, you know, vaccines, and then, you know, make more room for what he calls focal practices. And for Borgman, a focal thing or focal practice is something that you can center your life around. So historical examples would be like religion, which, you know, in medieval Europe was a very focally oriented society insofar as the church and, you know, God was the center of all of society. And from there, you know, people knew what they were doing, what their meaning in life is. It was all given to you, right? Insofar as being part of that kind of world. And obviously today we don't have that kind of center focality in most cultures, but we definitely can still have forms of individual focality, things that make our lives worth living, that give us meaning, that give us orientation, and that give us a way to engage with the world and with each other. And so the examples he talks a lot about are sports. Sports bring a lot of people together. Yeah. They engage the body. They engage the mind. There's a kind of excellence there that you can work towards as an individual, which is, you know, a really good way to be in the world, so to speak. Art, music, gardening, cooking, you know, having a family, having something you're proud of. Those kinds of things he thinks are orienting and focal. And we, you know, instead of, you know, turning to technology to make our lives easier and easier, we should be using technology instead to make more room for these kinds of practices. You know, his famous example is you can either sit at home all day and, you know, sit on the couch, or you could go for a run and then come home and have a shower, and the shower then facilitates, you know, the ease of the run. Then if it's raining outside, you don't have to be like, oh, I don't want to go outside and, you know, go for a run in the rain. You can be like, well, I can because I'll come home and shower. So in that way, you know, we're using the device of a shower in a way to promote kind of the focal practice of running. So in that sense, that's how we should be kind of looking at devices, instead of thinking about how more and more we can, you know, use devices to make our lives easier, right? And I think, as you said, generative AI, I think, is a really good example of how we're moving in the opposite direction, where, you know, instead of AI doing my laundry, AI is like making art and, like, you know, like stealing work from people and reproducing it. And, you know, that's kind of the unfortunate part, because that's going the opposite direction. We should be, you know, kind of centering around, you know, those kinds of things, instead of, you know, ceding it to, you know, what is easy, what is available, what is convenient, what is effortless, and kind of, yeah. So I feel like that's definitely a prescient aspect of his thought.
Well, it sounds, like you said, very prescient for the time right now, especially as we're seeing lots of, you know, the general public and just regular everyday folks asking themselves, like, you know, like, what is the point of doing certain things when something else, like Gen AI, might be able to use that. And people are really balancing, you know, what are they gaining? What are they losing from using, and I guess Borgman's words, using these devices? Like, what do you gain? What do you lose? And I think we need to have a serious conversation as a society right now. And it sounds like Borgman can really offer us a lot to think about, you know, what are the benefits and what are the challenges by using different types of technology, and what are we willing to give up and what are we willing to hold on to as we move forward. Do you have a favorite passage of Borgman's work?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, can you tell us? Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, so this passage didn't appear in any of his published work until his final book, which was published posthumously in 2023. It's called Moral Cosmology, and it's kind of a collection of the stuff he was working on towards the end of his career. And unfortunately, it is kind of unfinished in the sense that he unfortunately passed away before he could finish the last chapter and kind of polish it up. So it definitely reads like that. But you can kind of see his aim at the end of that was to tie together his kind of life's work, in the sense that, you know, he started with, you know, the technology question, and then he continued through his theory of history, and he talks a lot about ethics in his Real American Ethics book in 2006. So this book was kind of a way to draw it all together and kind of see, you know, what role that we have to play in, you know, the world, people, and then what is the role between, you know, science and the humanities. He talked a lot about that. And, you know, can we have a cosmology today? And a cosmology is kind of just a fancy word for saying, can we have an explanation for, like, why we're here and what we're doing here, right? And, you know, historically, like, all cultures have a moral cosmology, right? Like, you know, Christian Europe has a very clear Christian cosmology of, you know, how the world began and, you know, where it's going. Indigenous cultures have a very clear cosmology. He talks a lot about that as well. but we obviously don't have one anymore in, you know, kind of secular Western society. And so he's trying to see if we can take, you know, from science, you know, and kind of build up a theory of the universe that's, you know, not incorrect in terms of a physics way, but gives us some kind of purpose and meaning. So that project is a bit unfinished for sure. But he at the end of the book, he cites this passage, and I think it illuminates what I was talking about earlier with focal practices. You know, I keep using the word orientation, and that's a really funny word. It's a weird word you don't hear a lot anymore. You think, what do you mean, like, orient? Like, you know, this passage kind of illuminates what he means by orientation, what he means by having a focal thing or focal practice that centers your world. And in his later work, you know, he talks a lot about completeness. You know, we want to have a complete life, a complete world. And, you know, the kind of consumerist hedonic treadmill that we're on today and technology kind of promotes is not complete. It never can be complete, right? You can never buy too much stuff. There's always more stuff to buy. There's always more, you know, devices to have. You can always make something easier and better and more quickly available or whatever it is. And that's not a complete life. And for that reason, there's this feeling of incompleteness. So this passage is kind of illustrates what Borgman means by completeness. And as he calls it, you know, it's kind of self-warranting. Like, you know, you don't then need to define necessarily, you know, what is a focal practice. What focal practice is this kind of centering. So the quote is, "There is no place I would rather be. There is no one I would rather be with. There is nothing I would rather do. And this I will remember well." And that passage actually he got from a retreat he went on back in the 50s, this Christian retreat. And he was speaking with a theologian there. And that he talks about this in actually an earlier interview, 1993 interview, but it comes back up in this final book. And then that's in the last page, actually. And I think that's also very fitting. And so basically the idea is that, you know, to have a complete life, to have a focal life, or to be involved in a focal practice is kind of to be able to say, wow, like, there's no place I would rather be than eating dinner with my family, or there's nothing I would rather do than, you know, be out here running, you know. And I think we've all had that feeling from time to time, right? It's kind of like a sublime, or as people call it, might call it flow state in psychology, right? And he says, you know, we need to be, that is what the good life is. That's a source of the good life that gives us all purpose and meaning. It's kind of a universal. And in that sense, we should be focusing on making a clearing for those kinds of experiences more, right? And the technology, he thinks, you know, obviously drastically reduces those experiences because it reduces our engagement with the world. And it reduces the way we might randomly come across something or someone that we're doing and suddenly we're really actually involved in this focal thing. Right. I really like that quote at the end. I think it's a very fitting kind of quote.
It's a nice, yeah, like you said, I think it's a nice summation of what you've been discussing and kind of a way to recognize when you're hitting those focal practices or those focal things. A nice way for you to quickly recognize if this is something that is worth your good life and the time that you have to spend on it. Oh, thank you for sharing that. What do you want people to know about philosophy in general and the role that philosophy can play in today's world as it rapidly changes and careens around? What do you want people to know about it?
It's a difficult question to answer because I feel like every philosopher is going to have a different answer. So by no means do I mean to speak for, you know, the academic philosophy profession as a whole. But I'm going to have to agree with Borgman insofar as I feel like philosophy today has become very narrow in the sense that there's a lot of people, a lot of really great work being done, a lot of diligent projects, but the projects are kind of just self-reinforcing projects. Everyone, you know, they're working on these really difficult technical questions, and there's a lot of collaboration with other philosophers on these kinds of questions, but there's not a lot of willingness to go beyond that kind of technical debate. You know, philosophy used to be, you know, at the base of everything. You know, that's where we got math and the physical sciences from, and art, you know, everything was once, you know, full under the branch of philosophy, right? And over time, you know, all those pieces have kind of left and gone off to do, you know, their own thing, right? And philosophy's now been kind of left with this question of like, well, you know, what is my purpose now, right? Like, kind of a retired person might be like, well, I spent my whole life working, you know, now what do I do with my free time? And I think that's caused a lot of disruption in terms of, you know, the discipline. So I'd say that a lot of the philosophers today are working on great projects, but I think they need to extend more and be maybe a little more speculative and daring. And I say that only because I work particularly in the continental tradition. So that's the tradition that came from continental Europe, is starting in the 1700s, and includes, you know, the big names like Heidegger, Nietzsche, Camus, the existentialist, Sartre. And those philosophers were more willing to take on more of a narrative or artistic style. They were often very dramatic. If anyone's ever read Nietzsche, like, he's very, very dramatic. He's almost to the point of being funny. And they're very polemic in a lot of instances. They have a lot to say about things. And, you know, today the predominant style of philosophy is analytic philosophy, which came from, you know, the Anglo-Saxon sphere around the World War I, World War II. And that is closer related to kind of, you know, the sciences or maths, mm-hmm. where they set out to solve a specific problem. So like formal logic, for example, and they set out like, you know, a logical problem. There's a lot of great work being done in analytic moral theory, which questions, you know, in this case, what should we do? You know, the trolley problem, I'm sure people have heard about. Those are all very classical kind of analytic questions. And so their style is a lot more formal. And a lot more, I would say, kind of limited in the sense that they're trying to be as clear and succinct as possible mm-hmm. in their answers, which is great. But I think that there is room to do, you know, the continental kind of side of philosophy, too. And I don't think there's anything wrong with a philosophy that does seek to be more speculative and more polemic, especially when we're talking about stuff like technology today, where there is lots of great work being done on, you know, the effects of this technology or that technology mm-hmm. or what have you. But I also think there's room for a lot more, I would say, drama almost and polemicism for sure. And I think that would also bring the general public more into conversation, because I think there's been a lot of fragmentation where the general public doesn't know what philosophy is anymore, what people are doing in it. And then, you know, philosophers are just kind of like, oh, well, they don't understand. They don't like us. You know, there's, you know, kind of a inferiority complex among all philosophers, I think, that, you know, we're not the hard sciences. And what are mm-hmm. we doing here? And I think that kind of inferiority or insecurity complex is something that all philosophers deal with. Even, I would assume, maybe even, you know, the ones who are famous and have great, you know, are, you know, deans of departments and stuff. I feel like even they must sometimes be like, wow, like, you know, because it's hard to do something that the rest of the world just doesn't respect mm-hmm. or feel like it's worthy. So that can be very difficult, especially when you're starting out in your career and people are like, well, why don't you go be a lawyer? Or why don't you go do something useful for society? But the best philosophers, I feel like, were ones who were doing a public service. They're public philosophers, right? So Dewey was another big public philosopher in America in the early 20s. Borgman really tried to be kind of a public figure. So in that sense, I think philosophy should be very public. It should be community oriented. And I think it should inform a lot of the kind of public conversations that we're having. And so in that sense, I think there's a lot of room for philosophy to do that today. And I hope that there kind of is more of that in the years to come.
I think people would welcome some philosophers' opinions on things, because right now I think, like you mentioned, there's not one central focal point for, you know, secular Western society. Mm-hmm. And I think people are searching for that. Mm-hmm. There may be multiple, of course, but mm-hmm. I think people would love to hear more from philosophers and their opinions on where we can find meaning. Mm-hmm. I think that is very, very important in the contemporary moment. Mm-hmm. Well, Abigail, thank you so much. It has been wonderful chatting with you and learning about your work on Borgman and how his ideas have influenced different aspects of your mm-hmm. life. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and best of luck with the rest of your research. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.